over here.
House Committee on Energy Resources will come to order. Clerk call the roll.
Chairman Darby.
Here.
Vice Chairman Anderson.
Here.
Bonin. Canales.
Here.
Clardy.
Present.
Mr. Craddock. Gira. Isaac.
Here.
King.
Here.
Lambert.
Here.
Landgraf.
Here.
Schubert.
Present.
Wally.
Here.
All right. Quorum's present. Good afternoon, everyone. I know we all want to be here at this special time together in Austin in the summer. Thanks to the members for being here. I know you're called on to be here, but I appreciate your presence here today. We're going to hear some good information, and it's an opportunity that we're going to have an interim committee meeting anyway to look at this and receive this report. So this allows us to kill a couple of birds with one stone. So appreciate you being here. We have two items on the agenda today, HCR 20. I had that originally going to go first, but I think I'm going to have to go to Ways and Means and vote on some bills here at 2:30. So we're going to start with the TAMIS report and receive that, and then we'll have time for question, and hopefully I'll be back by then. But members, you're free to grill them at any length and for however long you care to. So, but this report was recently released by the Academy of Medicine, Engineering, and Science of Texas. We'll refer to that as TAMIS, that explores the impacts of shale oil and gas development. And we're going to have several representatives from TAMIS with us today, and we look forward to hearing from them. So with that, I will say, with regard to the report, we're going to focus on three of the issues that were addressed in the report: seismicity, water, and transportation. All those are very important to each one on this committee. We've made the full report available to you and your staff. It's known that shale oil and gas development has fundamentally changed the energy sector for this country and certainly for this state, and had a profound economic and social impact on our state. Despite all these positive benefits, we have a responsibility to make sure that shale oil and gas development is conducted in a manner that is safe for our citizens, the environment, and our critical infrastructure. The report that is being presented before us today addresses these important topics, and I'm looking forward to our discussion with members from TAMIS. With that, members, any questions or opening comments that you may have? If not, I'd like to call our first panel. Chair calls the Honorable Gordon England, President of TAMIS.
Thank you.
Melinda Taylor, General Overview of, will give us a general overview of shale development. And Brian Stump. Welcome, Brian. Danny Reibel, lead author of Water Quality and Quantity, and John Barton, lead author of Transportation. It's interesting to see you here, John, in another role other than with TxDOT. So welcome to all the panel. So with that, why don't we start with my right, Mr. England.
Good, thank you. So, Mr. Chairman and the members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. It's our pleasure. We hope this is very informative for you. So I am Gordon England. I'm the board president of TAMIS. So first, thanks again for the invitation to be here. Also, thanks to all the members for your service to the state of Texas. And also, Mr. Chairman, I do want to personally thank you from my time in the Pentagon. I want to thank you for your support of the military. And I know there's bases in a lot of the members' districts, and if there are, I thank you. But I know there's people who serve in the military and their families in all your districts, so I thank you. I was always proud to have the state of Texas such a great supporter of our military, so I thank you.
Thank you. I think you'll find every member of this committee strongly supports our military.
No, I know that, and I thank you for that support. You're familiar with the subject today, and hopefully this is a dialogue. We are respectful of your time. We know this is a special session and you have a lot of demands, so we will be concise and direct. But we will hopefully have a lot of time for dialogue, and at any time, feel free. Questions, as the chairman said, feel free to grill us at any time at all. We would appreciate that, frankly. So a little bit about TAMIS. TAMIS has about 280 members. To be a member of TAMIS, you need to be a member of one of the National Academies. So if you're a member of the National Academy of Engineering, Science, or Medicine, or Nobel Laureate in the state of Texas, then you are a member of the Texas TAMIS organization. And we have 18 research institutions, universities that are affiliates of our organization. So we are very closely aligned to all of the researchers in the state of Texas. Now, what we do as an institution is that we promote research in the state. We try to recognize rising research stars in the state. And the theory is quite simple. That is, apples fall around the tree. So if you have a great research institution, state of Texas, typically that spawns high-tech energy in the state, high-tech jobs, well-paying jobs, and is good for our citizens and for the state of Texas. So we are a resource in the state of Texas. Everyone in our organization is a volunteer. We do have a small staff permanently here in Texas, but the 280 members give their time freely, volunteer to help the state of Texas. This study was commissioned by the TAMIS board to help inform the state policymakers and the public because, frankly, we wanted to remove the emotion from a subject that has a lot of emotion attached with it. So this, you will hear, this is a scientific-based study, and therefore it is fact-based. Our objective was to make it balanced, unbiased, and inform consensus on the impact of shale oil and gas development in the state of Texas. And I hope we have met that objective, and we are delighted to brief it to you today in summary form. As you go into the interim, please know that we are available and would be more than willing to work with any of the members, Mr. Chairman, or any of the staffs if any issues come up during the interim time. So with that, I will
turn. Why don't you talk a little bit about, I think it would be helpful to know how the study was funded and kind of let us know. I obviously see Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation, but we know those folks and their relationship with the oil and gas industry. But this is an extraordinary effort on that foundation's part to help shed some light on all of these areas.
So the funding, they were an important funding source, although most of the funding was from the TAMIS itself.
Okay.
So our own internal funds, but frankly, we solicit outside funds because we have no source of funds per se except for foundations and people willing to support our studies.
Okay.
So they were indeed of significant help to us, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Melinda Taylor for the overview.
Great. Thank you very much, Gordon, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, all the members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My role is to give you just an overview of the process that we use to write the report, and then I will hand the reins over to three of my colleagues from the task force who will do the deeper dive into the findings and recommendations with respect to water, seismicity, and transportation. So I am on the faculty of the University of Texas School of Law. I teach energy law courses and environmental courses. And I founded a center 3 years ago called the K. Bailey Hutchison Center for Energy Law and Business that does unbiased research and convenes experts on energy to discuss topics that are of particular interest to the industry and to the community at large. Let me start with just a little bit of context to help place our findings and recommendations. And Mr. Chairman, you referred to or alluded to some of this in your opening remarks, but there is no question that Texas is the nation's energy leader. Absolutely no question. We all know that. We're the leading number one producer of oil and gas in the United States. Indeed, if we were a country, there would only be six nations that produced more oil and gas than the state of Texas. I mean, it's a dramatic contribution that we make to this nation's energy supply. We're also the number one producer of wind power, which I think is interesting. We have a very diverse energy portfolio in Texas. Last year in 2016, 1.1 billion barrels of oil and gas were produced here. So that's, you know, again, an extraordinary amount. And oil and gas production is ubiquitous in the state of Texas. It occurs in 215 out of our 254 counties. So it occurs across our state in multiple different climates and ecosystems and affects large communities, small communities. It's everywhere. It's a huge economic driver, as we all know. In 2016, $1.7 billion worth of revenue for our schools from property taxes was generated by oil and gas production. And then there are countless other economic benefits that we're well aware of. Jobs, economic activity at the local level, state tax revenue, and so forth. All of this is possible, as we, again, are well familiar, because of the renaissance that's occurred in this industry since 2007, 2008, with that very unique combination of technologies of hydraulic fracking and horizontal drilling. That's what's made this all possible here in Texas and elsewhere across the country. What our study was designed to do was to look at those benefits, which we've tried to document in our report, but also recognize that with all of that new activity that's occurred in the last decade or so, there also have been some impacts, some environmental impacts and impacts to our infrastructure and impacts to the environment. And so that's what our report attempted to focus on. Oops, sorry. So this is just a slide that describes our statement of task. We did not do original research in our among our task force. Instead, we looked at peer-reviewed scientific studies that are available. And as Gordon said, we meant to sort of sift through the static, if you will, and find those areas that really represent the best scientific information and amplify those and not pay attention to some of the sort of misleading things that are out there, especially in the popular press. We wanted to communicate what that state of knowledge is, and then identify gaps and make recommendations about both additional research that might be carried out by academics or by others, as well as begin to suggest areas that the legislature and other policymakers might want to be considering over the coming years. This slide shows our membership. We had 19 experts that participated in this task force. They came not only from academia, although it just so happens that all of us on the panel today are academics, but they also came from the industry, from the environmental community, and from state government agencies. So we had a broad range of perspectives. I think we had a very rigorous and sort of vital debate over various issues, and I believe came up with a very solid set of findings and recommendations. I'm not going to go over this slide in any detail. This just emphasizes and illustrates the points I made earlier about the widespread nature of the oil and gas development in our state, as well as what we project to happen over the coming decades. We don't see this declining. This is going to continue to be a very important industry to our state and to the nation, for that matter. These are the environmental areas that our report touches on. As the chairman noted, we're only going to talk today in any detail about water issues, seismicity, and transportation. Although I was the lead on the chapter that dealt with land issues, I could certainly answer questions about that today or at a future point. And of course, we also dealt with air issues. And the lead on that, David Allen, who's one of my colleagues at UT, would be happy to answer questions as well. This final slide is just meant to emphasize that these various environmental and social impacts are interrelated. I think one of the contributions that our task force has made to this sort of body of knowledge is that we did bring together experts from a variety of different subject matters. So we had John Barton, who's arguably the leading expert on transportation issues in Texas, to talk about transportation-related issues. Brian Stump, who's the leading expert on seismicity, to talk about seismicity. Danny Reibel on water issues. But we were able to look at all these issues, both individually, but then discuss those interrelationships and the interdisciplinary challenges of addressing those issues in the context of the task force. I think our overriding recommendation with respect to future research is that research should be interdisciplinary in nature, and that any policy steps that are taken by this body or administrative agencies should keep in mind those interdisciplinary relationships because they're extremely important. The final point I'll make is that we found in the course of our discussions that there are certain areas that are better understood than others, where there's a lot of data. There are some areas where there's less data available. And I think it's important that academics as well as policymakers be aware of that difference and seek to close those gaps in knowledge. And with that, I'll stop. I'll answer any questions or just pass the mic to my colleague.
I would offer a suggestion since Mr. Reibel is it Reibel?
Reibel. That's correct.
Okay. Then I think you have a plane to catch, don't you? Okay. Well, we're gonna go right to you then, and we'll take the rest.
All right. Well, I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I did lead the water portion of the report, and I know that is of a lot of interest around the state of Texas, and I'm sure to your constituents and to yourselves as well. I wanted to take just a second and second some of Gordon's comments about we're really pleased as TAMEST, as the Texas Academy of Medicine, Engineering, and Science of Texas, in being able to try to provide some advice or a review of the technical topics. We very much would think that this is a role that we can try to fill, and pleased to be able to do that. I am a member of the National Academy of Engineering and a member of the board of TAMEST as well, and so pleased to see this come to fruition. As I mentioned, I was focused primarily on the water issues in this report. And I'm the Donovan Maddox Distinguished Engineering Chair at Texas Tech University. Previously, I was the director of the Center for Research in Water Resources at the University of Texas before being lured to the West. Water is clearly very important to everything that I do, and in 2011, I think everybody in the state of Texas recognized it's important to everything that they do. That was our worst single-year drought in history, and it also was a year that coincided with a lot of growth in the shale development, and that caused a lot of focus and interest and concern relative to water issues around shale development. And that's what we were attempting to address. TAMEST has tried to address some of these topics in the past. I led for TAMEST two water summits in 2012-2014, where we attempted to try to identify some of the key issues and how we might resolve these issues. But specifically relative to shale development today, there are a variety of water issues in this around water, and certainly one of the first is associated with just the use of water for hydraulic fracturing and in shale development. There's no question it uses a lot of water. We're looking at wells that, as the intensity increases, more recently some of those wells it might use 10 million gallons of water or more. So it does use an awful lot of water. But there's a couple of things that are mitigating factors that I invite you to keep in mind that we focus on in the report. One is that as a source of energy, shale development is actually not very water intensive. If we compare to some of the other sources of energy, they actually use far more water. Biofuels may be a great renewable resource for energy, but it is actually terrible for us relative to water use. In addition, when we look at the total amount of water used for shale development, it isn't a great deal relative to our other water uses. About 85% of the water in Texas goes to either agriculture consumption or residential consumption. The shale development is less than 1% of the total water consumption. So on a statewide basis, it's not a great deal. But again, as I mentioned, in 2011, our worst single year of drought in Texas history was the same year when the number of trucks carrying water to these wells was increasing and focused a lot of attention on that. And certainly in some rural areas, especially counties that don't have much agricultural activity or perhaps no urban areas, shale development is a very significant water user. And for that reason, the report highlighted trying to identify alternative sources and expanding the use of alternative sources of water, including the produced water itself, the water that comes up from the formation during the oil and gas development, during the oil and gas production, and then brackish water supplies that can't be directly used for drinking water. And those are being used a lot more than they were initially for the shale development. Certainly when we think of the new developments like Alpine High, I think most people recognize that the ability to develop the Alpine High is going to be a strong function of how efficiently and effectively we manage water resources to make that possible. Certainly ourselves, as well as others across the state, are trying to address some of those issues. So water use is important, but perhaps not as important as it might seem when we think of it as again, the number of trucks in 2011. There was also a lot of initial concern across the country about the hydraulic fracturing process itself and whether this could lead to contamination of our water resources. And in Texas, I think it's fair to say that this is extremely unlikely, primarily because of the large separation between the very deep formations that we're trying to develop for oil and gas, the shale formations, and where our drinking water aquifers might be. In some other parts of the country, that's not true. This is an area that is not nearly as much of a concern, or shouldn't be as much of a concern, as was perhaps originally registered by the public. One of the reasons that the water that is contamination of those waters may be of concern, however, is because of these formation waters that come up with oil and gas production are of very poor quality in Texas. And the spills and leaks in the near surface can be a much more serious issue, even though we don't expect direct connection between the fractured reservoirs and the drinking water. But we could have spills and leaks in the near surface or at the surface that could pose a problem. This produced water, the water from these formations, is typically triple the salinity of seawater or more. That also limits our options to be able to deal with it. There's a lot of interest, for example, to be able to treat that water and use it more beneficially, perhaps for agriculture. I would suggest that in the report we try to identify that, in fact, the ability, because of the high salinity of that water, to use it for drinking water or agriculture uses is quite limited. It can, however, be used for hydraulic fracturing fluid itself, and again, the industry is finding ways to make that happen and to be able to use it directly. But I think the chances that in some states there are opportunities to use produced water because it is not of such poor quality, with little treatment for agriculture perhaps or for even other uses, but that is in general not true in Texas. I somewhat jokingly suggest that if we were going to try to add to drinking water supplies in portions of Texas, it would be easier and cheaper to desalinate seawater and pump it there than it would be to try to treat some of this extremely poor quality water.
Excuse me, Mr. Wright, let me ask you just a question. Sorry to interrupt you there. You mentioned that there was some difference with the state of Texas and some of these other fines. I wonder if you compare, as far as the drinking water aquifer strata, say the Marcellus in the Northeast.
Well, the Marcellus there's a number of different formations that are in the Marcellus, and some of those are closer to drinking water aquifers than others. There are also some other locations of relatively shallow water. I believe in Wyoming there are some fields that are fairly close to drinking water aquifers, and those could be more of a concern. And there's also quite a variation across the country in terms of the quality of this formation water that is the produced water as well.
And most of the formations you're talking about in Texas, though, are, we do have that separation.
We do have that separation in Texas, and the quality of that water is fairly consistently poor in Texas. Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
So I think there is concern because of the poor quality of this produced water. These spills and leaks can be more of a concern, and we highlighted that in the report. And perhaps an unfortunate side effect of that is that if we try to reuse that water and we handle that water more, it actually may cause more opportunities for spills and leaks. But we do believe in the report that it is important that we make use of of that water, perhaps for hydraulic fracturing, but it's not going to be, again, in general, available for agricultural or drinking water. It's just too poor quality to allow that. One of the challenges that we found is that we know less about the spills in Texas than we might elsewhere. In particular, in for example, when people are trying to identify the source of spills and leaks, what causes these spills and leaks in oil and gas development, North Dakota is one of the leaders because their spills are reported on a accessible website, and they have a relatively small threshold of spills. In Texas, it's a little harder to get that information, and so we have less information, particularly of brines, of these produced waters. We know less about where the spills occur, at least to the general public knows less about where those spills occur and what volumes might they be. Certainly, if we're trying to address those concerns and trying to limit the amount of spills and leaks that could pose a problem, it would be better to know more about what those spills and leaks, where they came from, and to what extent they're occurring. Certainly, a lot of the we know well about the oil spills themselves, but less about these produced water and its brines, because we have no statewide reporting requirement for that. And as a result, we know a little bit less about those brine spills, but I think all of us are aware that a brine spill can have fairly substantial consequences to vegetation, to land, and if it goes into water, where there is, then there would be reporting. That leads us to some of the recommendations. We certainly encourage the use of other water resources, that is, other than fresh water, the use of that produced water, because it's such poor quality, the more that we can use that for hydraulic fracturing, the better. The making use of the brackish water supplies that isn't directly available for drinking water, the better that would be, a more efficient use of that. Actually, the brackish water resources in general are a resource to the state, and I hope that both our groups and others are working to try to make that more available, not just for shale oil development, shale oil and gas development, but also for perhaps in the cleaner amounts of that, perhaps to municipal, agricultural, and other uses. And then finally, I was mentioning the spill and leak reporting. I think there would be opportunities and advantages to improve that so that we can better understand where spills and leaks occur and how best to address them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Rival. Members, any questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Rival, for your testimony. You mentioned earlier the percentage of uses that are broken out, 85% ag and residential being the next category, and then you said less than 1%, basically. Is that an average, or was that just...
It's based upon... that. Those specific numbers are fairly consistent, but they represent the... from the 2012 Texas Water Development Board report, 58% was agriculture, 27% is okay. Residential. Okay. So this together they represent 85. The less than 1% is the when we look at total water consumption and how much of that is hydraulic fracturing, and that's a more recent number, not 2012.
Okay, so 2011, the year in which you recall was probably the most severe in Texas. That was included in that 2012 information?
That's correct. That would have been, it actually, there was somewhat less hydraulic fracturing usage at that point, but it's always been less than 1%.
But obviously just very heightened because everyone was aware, and certainly everyone was
I think that's exactly right. When you're San Angelo facing potential severe water shortage and watching trucks go to carry fresh water to pump down a hole was just something that made an impact on people.
Sure. Thank you.
Members, any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Thank you. In the book here in the recommendations, there's reference to the recent Railroad Commission of Texas rules encouraging recycling. Do you have any information on those rules? Or, Mr. Chairman,
yes,
will we hear from... Go ahead. That'd
I'm
be
sorry.
Great if you do. That's excellent. Thank you.
those rules were an attempt to allow beneficial uses of some of this poor quality water. I think one of the recommendations also points out that we're not yet sure whether that was sufficient to substantially increase the amount of reuse, and the effectiveness of those rule changes need to be tracked to identify whether they were in fact successful. We don't have good information as to whether they've changed usage in general. That is, that are we now putting a lot more produced water for hydraulic fracturing as a result of that rule? That's harder for me to say.
Sure. Well, do we have any resource witnesses here from the Railroad Commission planning to testify? Okay, I'll just visit with them offline. Thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Thank you, Ms. Rybold. Very informative. Appreciate that. And next we'll have Mr. Brian Stump, lead author of Geology and Earthquake Activity. Brian, it's all yours.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for inviting us to come and talk with you. I think the take-home message for the seismology component is twofold. And the first one echoes what my colleagues have talked about. The report represents a consensus between industry and regulatory and researchers studying earthquakes, and I think that's an important result in this process. The second thing is that your committee and the state has funded TexNet over the last 2 years, and there's funding for the next 2 years to further quantify, understand these earthquakes, and mitigate their effects. And so I think great progress has been made as a result of that. I've put this together just talking about the five findings first and then talk about the recommendations. And this will parallel again some of our other comments, but the first is that the great vast resources we have in Texas for oil and gas are a result of our tectonic history. And that tectonic history involves faults. And so we have a state, and this map shows known faults across the state. Most of these are not active at all, but they reflect the history across the state. The second conclusion is that indeed we have seen an increase in seismicity in Texas. Magnitude 3 is kind of a number that's used as since 1975 that we've been able to detect and locate magnitude 3 earthquakes in Texas. Also, that's about the magnitude that are felt by people. And prior to 2008, about 1 to 2 magnitude 3 earthquakes per year occurred. And since 2008, we've experienced 12 to 15 magnitude 3 earthquakes. That's not very many earthquakes. Our neighbors to the north in Oklahoma have a 100-fold increase over what we see in terms of seismicity. So this is sometimes needs to put into context. The third conclusion is that earthquakes, some of these earthquakes are linked to wastewater disposal, class 2 disposal wells, but not with hydraulic fracturing. And I would point out that that is often what we hear from in the press. And the committee and the research that we see is that those very rare cases where we have earthquakes in Texas.
Could you just repeat that one more time?
Sure.
Make sure everybody got that.
Yes, that the earthquakes, some of the earthquakes that we see in Texas are related to wastewater disposal, class 2 wells. There are not earthquakes that are of felt levels that are related hydraulic fracturing in Texas.
Thank you.
And it's usually not well communicated about that process. So that's a very important conclusion.
Excuse me for jumping in, yep. Chairman, but because usually the press quite often misreports that, and it creates
a lot of
confusion.
Absolutely. And so there's consensus in the community.
So I'm going to jump into, Mr. Chairman. So in your opinion, if we had
Mr.
more,
Isaac.
Thank you. If we had more water recycling, would we have less wastewater disposal?
It seems to be that there is a relationship between the disposal of wastewater in the subsurface and the triggering of old faults that have existing stress on them.
Okay. Thank you.
The fourth conclusion is that in Texas, as part of TexNet, we're increasing the number of seismic stations to 43 across the state, and that provides the regulatory organizations precise earthquake locations and quantification of the earthquakes, and that is an important, and that network is almost complete and beginning to operate for the state of Texas, and that's part of the TexNet funding. And then finally, the wastewater disposal wells near earthquake locations now receive special approval from state regulators. And I think that also is an important process as we look at mitigating these effects.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Thank you. Any other state, Oklahoma in particular, is there any other state that you're aware of that is any other nation anywhere that has gone as far as Texas has in trying to work through this issue and get to the bottom of it, deploy the proper scientific equipment and do the right studies and take the right regulatory steps?
It's my opinion that Texas takes the lead in terms of instrumentation, funding the analysis of the data, and working with industry and trying to understand the subsurface and the resulting earthquakes.
And am I correct, too, that with a little patience and a little bit of time, we're going to learn more and more about these issues and be able to address them more and more?
Exactly. So that's part of – I've got some more viewgrass, but I think you kind of understand, and that's part of as we begin to locate these events better and as we work with industry and quantify where the faults are and how the fluids move, that provides us a physical understanding to mitigate or eliminate these kinds of things.
Great. I live by all those little green dots that were on that pretty previous slide there.
That's the take.
Pretty interesting time.
And actually, I think maybe I might go on to the last recommendations, because that follows with what you had mentioned. Our first recommendation is that the data, the geology, the subsurface material properties, the locations need to be shared among people that study these kinds of problems. And the second thing is that data needs to be made available in common formats, and I think there's progress being made in the form of TexNet. And then these kinds of, that Representative King had mentioned, these kind of integrative studies to understand what the specific role of the fluids in earthquakes, and so providing an opportunity to think about how far away should an injector be from a fault, how much fluid can I inject, what level should I be able to inject. We are beginning to understand those questions, but I think the integrative studies that are going on at the BEG, at the University of Texas, Texas A&M, and a small part at SMU, I think will provide the basis for looking towards the future.
Ms. Chairman.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quick question for you. I'm going to speak in extreme generalities here for a second. A lot of the oil and gas production historically in Texas has been out of the middle of nowhere. We've seen a rise in urban area activity, which I think has given a certain increase in the exposure to these sort of things. You have models that you, I'm sure you're going to talk about here that develop a lot of this stuff. Do you have models that differ versus rural drilling operations versus urban? Is that a difference that you're making in your studies?
So what I would say is that if I were to answer that question, it would be the difference between hazard and risk, and there's a section on the difference. Hazard is the actual size of the earthquake and the amount of ground motion. But the risk is the superimposition of that hazard on an infrastructure. So an example would be that if we were in far west Texas and we had a magnitude 5 earthquake, there'd be a lot of ground motion, but if there weren't very many buildings nearby, then the risk would be very small. On the other hand, I live in Dallas, so let's move to the Fort Worth Basin. In that case, where you have 7 million people that live above the events, particularly with an infrastructure of buildings that weren't designed for earthquakes, a more moderate-sized earthquake might cause more damage. And so there are models. In the United States, it's a combination of the USGS and FEMA that work together in that. And TexNet is helping input data into those kinds of estimates to help us think about those things. And it is I would add, it's important for planning. And so municipalities can think through what they might do.
Members, any other questions? Mr. Stump, were you finished there?
Yes.
One question I'd like to ask on, you mentioned that Oklahoma was 100-fold over Texas, and was such close proximity. Is that geographic in nature, or is that procedural regulation?
No, it has to do with the geology. Okay. So in some of the formations where they recover natural gas and fracture, they're very rich in fluids, and so they get back a lot of the brines, more brines than we do here, and so there's larger volumes of fluids to dispose of.
Well, thank you. Yes, Mr. Lambert.
And so you mentioned earlier, and I'm assuming most of the data is 10 years old now. I mean, we have relatively short length of time that we've been accumulating this data.
Seismically, a magnitude 3 and above goes back to 1975.
Okay.
Because as a nation, as we begin to build nuclear power plants across the United States, earthquakes are a hazard and a risk for nuclear power plants. And so the federal government put a network in that could monitor down to magnitude 3.
So your comment about being patient and waiting.
Yes.
How many more years of data?
Well, I think so. This first 2 years of the TexNet has installed the networks, has begun some of these interactions between industry and the research community, as well as the seismologists. And so I would think that we're going to see rapid progress in the next 2 years.
Okay. Thank you.
That's my opinion.
Thank you, Brian. And then last but not least, John Barton, who's the lead author for transportation. John?
Thank you, Chairman Anderson. For the record, old habits for the record, my name is John Barton. I had the distinct privilege and honor of serving the citizens of Texas as the Deputy Executive Director and Chief Engineer at Texas Department of Transportation, retired there in August of 2015. And as the Chairman said, had the pleasure of working on this task force as the lead author for the transportation chapter. The information that I'll share with you, I think, is fairly well-known because of the extent of this activity across the state of Texas. But the bottom line is simply this, that the current technologies that we benefit from in the development and production of oil and gas across the state of Texas is dependent upon a significant amount of heavy truck traffic, and those volumes are much greater than we have seen in the past. And because of that, we are experiencing a degradation of the transportation network that is dependent, or that this industry is dependent upon and must have to continue to produce and be viable. And the root cause is that, simply stated, most of these highways, I think as was previously said by Representative Schubert, a lot of these activities are in the, quote, middle of nowhere. And those lower volume roadways, farm-to-market roads, state highways, county roads, and city streets were never designed nor envisioned to carry and sustain the level of traffic and the weight of traffic that is occurring in these areas. And so consequently, we are seeing a deterioration or consumption of these networks. This is just some visual representations of the types of conditions that often occur on these lower volume roadways in areas where oil and gas production and exploration and development is taking place around the state of Texas. One of the things that is not clear and evident to many people, but is an important part of understanding the challenge, is the fact that as the weight of a vehicle increases, the amount of roadway strength or pavement consumption that occurs does not go up in a linear fashion. And this is we try to represent it in this graph. I'll just simply point to a couple of examples to make this point. If you look in the middle columns, if you will, where it says with respect to a 35,000-pound truck, which is the typical weight of an empty tractor-trailer unit used in these activities. Most of us refer to those as an 18-wheeler. At an empty weight of 35,000 pounds, they do a certain amount of consumption. When that truck is fully loaded at 84,000 pounds, which is with permits, the legal weight that's allowed for most of these vehicles, the weight has gone up by 2.4 times, but the amount of consumption has increased 38 times because of the fact that it's an exponential increase in the amount of pavement necessary to carry those weights. And so on these roadways where we're seeing larger volumes and heavier weights of truck traffic, those impacts are occurring very rapidly, and that's what's causing the consequences that we see across the state of Texas. Research was conducted by the Texas A&M Transportation Institute, commissioned by the Texas Department of Transportation, and we found that the financial cost to those increased consumptions would equate to about $1 billion per year to rebuild or rehabilitate those farm-to-markets and state highway systems in these areas that we see these kinds of consumptions. If you add the county roads and city streets to that equation, then the cost would go up to about $2 billion per year. And at the same time, as those conditions begin to decline, The industry is seeing additional impacts in that they're not able to have the same levels of production because they have to drive slower along rougher roads or in areas where the pavement has deteriorated, and so they have lower production and increased wear and tear on their vehicles, and that was estimated to be costing the industry about $1.5 to $3.5 billion per year in addition to the cost of repairing and reconstructing the transportation network. Another dramatic consequence of all of this that was seen around the state of Texas over the last decade as we've really understood these opportunities is the increase in vehicle crashes because of the volume of traffic increases in some of these areas. It's a simple physics equation. The more vehicles you have on a roadway, the more likelihood you're going to have vehicle crashes. And because a lot of these vehicles are commercial vehicles, the increase related to commercial vehicle activities was seen as well. So when we compared 2 4-year periods back-to-back in the Eagle Ford and Permian Basin areas, we saw that in some areas of the state that had historically had lower traffic volumes and much lower truck traffic volumes, there were over 75% increases in crashes and fatal crashes occurring in these areas. And, of course, is a big concern for all of us.
Yes, and can I just make a comment on that? I represent Wise County, which is where it all started, I guess.
Barnett Show, yes, sir.
And we noticed, as the play really picked up, that all of a sudden Wise County went, not pro rata, but in actual numbers, to having the third highest number of auto truck fatalities. And, of course, we were very disturbed by that. And we looked into safety matters and everything else, and then we finally just realized that if you went and parked on any of the farm-to-market or any of the state highways, that 4 out of every 5 vehicles driving by were a truck. So simply, just statistically, if you had a wreck, the odds were you were going to get hit by a truck and not another car, because 4 out of 5 vehicles were a truck. And if you get hit by a truck, you're going to get hurt. And so, you know, we took some measures to try to address that with some success. It's just like you say, at the end of the day, if every third vehicle is a truck, then you've got a 3 to 1 chance that if you hit something, you're going to get hit by a truck. And it's just a very unfortunate factor, but there's not a lot that you can do to that other than just stressing truck safety, driver safety, looking for where the accident are occurring, doing some traffic studies to see if you need a light or better lighting or something like that there.
That's exactly right, Chairman King. Oftentimes people want to cast blame or assign responsibility or fault for these situations. But when you have these increases in commercial vehicles on roadways where they weren't before necessarily, a couple of things happen. The people that are from that area aren't used to driving around that much truck traffic. And trucks, you know, are different than passenger vehicles, and you have to drive around them differently and behave in those areas. They're not used to that volume of traffic. I know for my parents, they were used to very few people going down the county road they lived on, and all of a sudden there were a lot of vehicles, and they had to be more careful just pulling in and out of their driveway because there were increased volumes. There are situations where improvements can be made to the infrastructure, perhaps widening a roadway, putting in a right or left turn lane, putting in traffic signals. But a lot of cases, it's really more about driver awareness and education, and those are the things that we need to focus on. And rather than assigning blame, it's just adjusting to the reality of the conditions that have changed.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
John, you got to excuse me. I might be getting ahead of you here. One of the things I've been interested in, and you maybe can shed some light on this, what type of studies are being done about these substances we're making roads out of to make them more stronger, durable, whatever the word is? Can you shed some light on that?
Yes.
Knowing what I know about some other things that are going on in my neck of the woods?
Right. So in response to all of this, it's part of the conclusions, but the Texas Department of Transportation, our county judges, city mayors, councils, state legislators have certainly stressed the importance of working with industry, both the oil and gas industry as well as our highway construction and maintenance industry, to find ways to make improvements to the roads that last longer, will withstand these increased traffic volumes, because it's not going away. It may ebb and flow as the price of oil goes up and down, but the activity will be there for decades to come. And so being more proactive about the types of materials that we're using, the pavement structure itself, how deep we build it to begin with, how wide we construct the roadway, are things that the department with our universities and research agencies have looked at with the road building industry and their advice and input. And so the Texas Department of Transportation, through the leadership of the commission, as well as by the encouragement of the legislature, has started focusing in on energy sector programs where we are specifically identifying corridors and roadways to make those improvements so that we perhaps add some kind of modifier to the roadway base, cement, lime, fly ash, something like that, to make it stronger, adding additional depth up front, because we found that if we can improve the pavement condition, increase the load carrying capacity of the roadway before the traffic occurs, the cost of doing that is much, much lower than the cost of rebuilding the road once the damage occurs. It's a magnitude of 7 times over. And so those are the types of things that we're doing, Representative Schubert, and is a forward-looking, proactive approach to being prepared for the next wave of upon wave of activity that we know will occur across the state. Just a few more points to make. The summary of the major takeaways is that we know that we will continue to see these large volumes of traffic as the industry continues to grow and blossom over the years to the benefit of Texas. Our current system was not designed for these things, and so we have to make changes to the way that we design and build out and maintain these facilities. The crashes that are occurring are a severe consequence, and we have to be thoughtful about driver education and appropriate signage, signalization, roadway improvements, and it takes all of those things, not one single thing, to be able to address that. And then the last thing is that when we looked at this in totality, the cost of doing these things that we've been talking about is relatively low in comparison to the benefit that the industry brings to the state of Texas and to our citizens. And so when you look at it from a benefit-cost ratio, it is a good business decision to be able to move forward on some of these things. So our recommendations, as we looked at the totality of the volume of information available to us, is that it would be beneficial to have, I think is a common thread here, more and better quality data about the potential for oil and gas production, exploration, and development around the state so that we can better predict where activity may occur and get ahead of the game before the truck volumes start to occur. Secondarily, developing an integrated multimodal transportation system to carry not only the produced products but also the water and sand and other things that are necessary for it would be important. Today, most of that is carried by trucks on our roadways because we don't have the extent of pipelines that perhaps will develop over time as these newer fields start to develop and mature. We certainly don't have the rail network in a lot of these areas that would help address some of these things. And even the use of the Gulf Intracoastal Waterway may play a role in helping pull some of this traffic off of roadways and onto waterways. And so encouraging and being thoughtful about the development and the use of an integrated multimodal transportation network will help equalize the loading and not have all of it placed on the roadways itself. And then the last thing, which is perhaps the area where we've seen a change over the last biennium in a very, very positive direction, is the identification and provision for a reliable and sustainable funding source to address these challenges. And through the leadership of the legislature, the support of the Texas voters, we've been blessed with Proposition 1, Proposition 7, which has brought more revenue for transportation purposes into the Texas Department of Transportation. And because of the interest that you have shown and the leadership that you have provided, the Texas Transportation Commission has responded accordingly and have targeted and carved out some of those fundings, which in many cases, in much of the case, is coming from the severance taxes paid by the industry, to redirect those back into improvements in the areas where they're most needed to support the industry itself. So, Chairman, those are my conclusion of my prepared remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, John. Members, any questions? We thank all y'all for your testimony.
Thank you. On the transportation side of things, were there any studies or is there any technology or information available that shows efficiency? I'm curious if there's any information out there that talks about deadhead miles of fleets, and if there's any way that technology can help improve efficiencies of trucks via better communication, and also in regards to truck weights. Because I know now to figure out a weight of a truck, you've got to get a weigh station.
Yes. So, yes, Representative Isaac, there has been some investigation done, some studies conducted to look at the use of technologies for both of those aspects. So one is understanding where vehicles are in a fleet, owned by an operator or a production company that can then route those vehicles to where they need to be more efficiently along roads that are perhaps better designed to carry that load to begin with without negatively affecting or impacting the production of that fleet itself. And so for passenger vehicles, we think about Waze. If you've used that technology on your smartphone, it can tell you the shortest or least time-consuming way to get from where you are to where you want to be. Those kinds of technologies are starting to make their way into the industry for fleet management. As you mentioned, the patrol, regulation, and control enforcement of weights is very difficult in a lot of these areas because we have narrow roads and it's not safe for law enforcement officers, weight enforcement officers to pull vehicles off and to check them. But there are technologies that are available that allow for checking of vehicles at other locations and then that vehicle being able to communicate to law enforcement that it's been checked, it's appropriately weighted, it has all the safety devices in place. That technology existed for freight movements along interstate highways. It's called PASS systems, but that same technology is being explored for use in the oil and gas industry to allow for a better enforcement capability. And so some of our industry players are looking into that. Clearly, the Department of Public Safety and the weights and measures law enforcement community is interested in that. So it's been explored. I can't speak to whether or not it's at a position where it's going to be extended into the industry at a larger scale, but it is technology that could be beneficial not only in managing fleets but helping understand weights and the quality of the vehicle that is carrying that load.
Okay. Do you have any numbers on the ownership of the fleets that are most of the trucks that are driving in the oil field industry, owner-operators, or are they company trucks?
I would not be the best to speak to that. I think you have some industry representatives here that will be testifying after us that could probably answer that question better than I could.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate
you,
it.
Thank you, Langret.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, I'm looking at the first bullet point there on the recommendation slide about improving availability and quality of data related to ongoing drilling activities or, you know, predicting where the next wave of drilling operations are going to be. Are you also intending to take into consideration, you know, ancillary activities? For example, my district's in the heart of the Permian Basin. Winkler County and Ward County are seeing, right now we're seeing just the first wave of a tremendous amount of mining of sand for basically frac sand. And this is activity that we've never seen before, even in a place like the Permian Basin that is as accustomed as anyone to oil and gas drilling activity. But, you know, we're hauling untold tons of sand out of the same places every day and either taking them to other areas within the same oil patch or to a railhead. But unlike most oil field traffic, this is going to be heavy traffic in the same place for a sustained period of time. You know, we're talking decades rather than maybe just a year or two at a time. Is that type of activity specifically with sand being taken into consideration?
Yes. So it's not just the production and exploration of oil and gas, but it is the commodities necessary. So around Brady, Texas, sand is a similar challenge now that in farther west Texas, those kinds of commodity flows are also starting to impact it. So the intent of that recommendation is that understanding the competitive tension in the industry and one company not wanting to share or tip their hand on where they are going next or what particular commodity or resource they may be pulling upon next because they don't want their competitor to know that in advance. Is there a way to anonymize that data so that we as a state could understand it and prepare for it without giving any unfair competitive advantage or exposing any competitive capabilities? And that's really, as we've talked to the industry, they've been very, very helpful. They want to be able to be a partner in making this type of additional and more readily understood of data available, but they're very, very concerned about having their business model exposed to their competitors. And so it's a bit of a challenge, but it is something that we believe still is possible, working with the industry to find ways to anonymize that data or to cleanse it of any information that others could take advantage of, but allow the resource agencies and the communities to prepare for what might be coming.
Okay. And if you are, and I think those are certainly great recommendations, and if you do want to improve the availability and quality of some data, if you want to come with me out to Ward County and Winkler County, I have some immediately available data for you on State Highway 302 and State Highway 18.
Well, maybe we could look at a sinkhole while we're out there as well.
We sure can.
I apologize for just now getting back. Have you addressed Judge Fowler from DeWitt County? Have you
talked? I know the Honorable Judge Fowler very well.
Okay. I'm sure your recommendations.
I call him the Honorable. I do address him.
He agrees with all your recommendations?
I think he would.
Okay.
I think he would. He probably had a few more to add to the list. Okay. But we'll let him speak for himself in that regard.
Okay. Well, good. Members, any questions? Thank you, panel. I didn't get to hear much of it, but I'm going to go back and review the record and the video, and thank you for your input. Thank you for your testimony before us today, and we'll call up the next panel.
So, Mr. Chair, just let me say thank you. I hope this has been helpful. Thank you for the opportunity to debrief this. And again, during the interim, we are a resource in the state of Texas. If we can be helpful to the committee, any of the members during the interim period, just call on us, and we'd be happy to accommodate.
I will say, without having heard the water portion, I am particularly proud of – I'm from West Texas, and water is the most important issue. And I think industry has shaped a wonderful balance. They've been very innovative, recognizing the agricultural needs of and our community's needs, and have developed systems of distribution, systems of treatment that have balanced those needs. And I think we're in a good position. We're a good position not only for the people, but agribusiness and livestock. So I would just tell everyone within the sound of my voice to continue to work together to find ways that we can balance these priorities. We can't have it all one way and to the detriment of the people who live and work in the area. But the industry has been very sensitive to that, and they have spent hundreds of millions of dollars to develop technology and distribution systems that will accommodate those water needs. So, look forward to reviewing your report, and thank you again for coming. And without any more committee questions, I guess you're free to catch your plane. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. This time the chair calls Ed Lonaker, Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Associations, Todd Staples, Texas Oil and Gas Association, Katie Carmichael, Texas Alliance of Energy Producers. There's some familiar faces. Well, let's see. Ed, since you're on the end, do you want to go first?
I would be happy to, Chairman.
Okay.
Chairman Darby, committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to be with you today. For the record, my name is Ed Longenecker, and I serve as president of TIPRO, the Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association. And on behalf of my organization and our 3,000 members, we appreciate the collaborative work that went into the TAMIS study and believe it contains a variety of very positive data points that illustrate the importance of the oil and gas industry to our state. So specific to the three topics being discussed today, I'd just like to mention some recent efforts by the legislature, state agencies, and the industry, all that have a common goal of protecting Texas citizens and the environment while supporting the responsible development of oil and natural gas in our state. On the topic of water, as we heard today and as you've known for a number of years, the report denotes that water utilized for drilling and hydraulic fracturing is minimal compared to other areas of water use in the state. But while this equates to a small fraction of overall water use, operators, the state, and the agencies and the legislature continue with efforts to support increased utilization of reclaimed, recycled, and brackish water in oil and gas operations. And in fact, recently this body helped to pass legislation sponsored by Speaker Craddock, certainly supported by my organization and I think the industry overall, that allows the City of Midland to secure contracts for large-scale reclaimed water projects. And the impetus behind this or the project behind this legislation was developed by a very large, very prominent oil and gas operator who was seeking to cut dependence on fresh water and move solely to utilizing recycled and reclaimed water in their operations. And this is a very positive trend that we're seeing in the industry with a number of operators. On the topic of seismicity, as emphasized today, thanks in large part to your leadership, the state of Texas continues to lead the country in efforts to study this important issue in order to provide more accurate and reliable data on seismic activity in the state. We are consistently strong supporters of the TexNet program, which has added more than or nearly 40 seismometers to the state's seismic monitoring network within the past year. And funding and legislative efforts to create and support TexNet have proven to be instrumental in efforts to study that issue, and that process is obviously ongoing. And as I've said before this committee previously, having accurate data is imperative to developing the right policies, regulations, and industry best practices. And I know we are certainly committed to supporting continued funding, research, analysis, and collaboration on that issue.
And by the way, I wasn't able to be here for Brian's presentation, but I'd be remiss if I didn't want to single out President Greg Fenves, University of Texas. The legislature kind of dropped the ball on some funding in that regard, and they have picked that up and are going to maintain that program and funding level with Bureau of Economic Geology. And I want to give a public shout out to President Fenves and thank the University of Texas system for that continued support for that program. So thanks for – I didn't have a chance to tell Brian that, but I wanted to say that publicly before the committee.
Excellent. So that's excellent news. And finally, regarding transportation, as emphasized in the report, a consequential byproduct of increased oil and gas activity is additional heavy-weighted truck traffic. During the 85th legislative session, the oil and gas industry worked extensively on an effort to provide a portion of revenue generated by oil and gas severance taxes to counties where oil and gas activity is occurring for road repair and maintenance. Unfortunately, that did not pass. It was filed yesterday, by the way, if you want to discuss that.
Okay.
But we support continued funding and certainly look forward to continuing those discussions with all of you and with county officials during the interim to find a long-term solution or something that's suitable and hopefully permanent.
Great.
With that, I'll conclude my remarks and appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. You're next. You're a man in the middle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Todd Staples of the Texas Oil and Gas Association. It's good to see you today. I guess if we weren't seeing you today, we'd be in Denver or some other state right now.
Some other place.
We're here, and we certainly appreciate your leadership for Texas and the good work that you do. And we thank you for the opportunity to comment on the TAMIS study. In looking and reading the report and hearing the testimony here today, it's very obvious. It covered a broad spectrum of science. It was a very thoughtful approach. And it's very clear to me that the report definitely concludes that shale development, that fracking has been a positive benefit for Texas, that fracking is being done in a very safe, environmentally sensitive and responsible way that benefits every single Texan. And I think it's probably not lost on members of this committee that the oil and gas activity right here in the Lone Star State has literally ushered in a new level of energy security for our entire nation. Some refer to it as energy dominance, but it's clear that this activity here in Texas is what is leading that effort. You know, I don't want to repeat what the study said and the author said. They did that very clearly. I will say this, that the study identifies some data gaps and some areas that need additional attention. I would say that the industry wholeheartedly agrees with that. We are very supportive of continued research. Our member companies invest millions of dollars every year to find better ways to be better stewards of the environment, and that's going to continue. I'd also say that these data gaps and these areas that do need additional research, all of that, I believe, is being directly addressed through both state and federal regulations or through industry involvement. So there's no loopholes there. It's being addressed. It is highly regulated. And I think we've got a definitely bright future ahead of us. The study as a whole paints a positive picture of oil and gas operations in Texas. It does confirm that you can have a good environment and a healthy economy, that these categories are not mutually exclusive. And this is a different story, I think, than you get sometimes just by reading the media headlines. But when you look at these independent studies that were done, it does confirm this. There's a lot of good news in this report for all Texans, and just I'll highlight a couple of other areas of good news. The Texas Workforce Commission announced that June employment in oil and gas extraction and support activities had a 5,000 job gain. This is 9 months of continued positive job growth, and this 5,000 figure exceeds the largest, biggest month gain in the boom period. So that is certainly good news. Other couple of areas to think about when you think about policies and how it affects our state and the nation. Over half of all U.S. oil and gas extraction jobs in the nation are located right here in the Lone Star State. This excludes pipeline jobs, refining jobs, and other jobs that are associated with it. So that's certainly good news. And we know that about half of all the rigs operating in the country today are right here. 75 to 80% of those are in the Permian Basin. And you're going to see through highs and lows, that's going to continue to be a very, very strong area of production and leading our nation and our world. One other quick example of the good news that can be summed up in one word is plastics. Because of low-cost natural gas, the feedstock, you're seeing a renaissance, a boom in manufacturing. A lot of that is occurring right here in the Lone Star State. You helped with legislation this last session that assured that would continue. But that not only benefits energy sector, the manufacturing sector, but it's important to note that due to shale drilling, U.S. petrochemical exports, which include plastics as well, but other items such as fertilizer, adhesives, and solvents, will grow through the tune of billions. So it's agriculture, it's energy, it's consumers, everyone benefits, and we appreciate your leadership and attention. Thank you for letting us be here today.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Members, any questions? Kelly? Or Katie, I'm sorry.
Kelly's my sister, actually. Thank you, Chairman and members. My name is Catherine Carmichael. I'm here today on behalf of the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers, a trade association proudly representing more than 3,000 members, primarily independent oil and gas producers. I'm also speaking on behalf of the Panhandle Producers and Royalty Owners Association, headquartered in Amarillo and roughly 600 members strong. Thank you again to Chairman Darby for holding today's hearing. We appreciate the opportunity to comment on the TAMIS report and the work done by the Distinguished Task Force. I will keep my comments brief. In regards to seismicity, we support fully funding the TxNet program and have gone on record to testify in support of the continuation of this important initiative. TxNet is a vital tool and an excellent example of academia and regulators working together to use science and facts to ensure that all activities in the oil field are safe and properly regulated. Furthermore, the Railroad Commission has adopted some of the most stringent and comprehensive standards in regards to seismicity to also ensure safety and environmental stewardship, in addition to hiring an in-house seismologist to study the most current data and coordinate with outside researchers. We applaud the work of both the Railroad Commission and the legislature in their proactive leadership towards addressing this issue. Moving on to water, as Texas operators continue to lead in innovation in the oil patch, look for the industry to be a leader in new water recycling technologies. We believe and agree that the current state statutes and regulatory framework are sufficient to ensure the protection of our water resources. And finally, in regards to transportation, we recognize and appreciate that roads are a priority and they are essential to our oil fields. However, industry already contributes billions of dollars to the state's coffers in the form of taxes and royalties, $13.8 billion in 2015 to be exact. With commodity prices remaining low, we would respectfully request that no new taxes be imposed on the industry. We believe the support of county roads should not rest entirely on industry's shoulders, but we could support a proposal or funding mechanism that uses some of the taxes industry currently contributes, particularly those paid into the rainy day fund, to use towards road maintenance and repair. Additionally, the amount of truck traffic in the oil patch may soon be alleviated with the advent of new technologies and drilling techniques, such as refracturing, which does not require the drilling of a new well, and increased water recycling. With that, I'll conclude my comments. Thank you again. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Katie. Members, any questions? Wow. You see any gaps? I mean, from the industry standpoint, is there any gaps here that you know, we need to kind of focus in on that this study reveals, that more information, anything from the industry standpoint that you'd like to see developed? I mean, I noticed some. I know Chairman Larson is very interested in mapping out all the brackish water aquifers and mapping all that, and it's got a lot of important groundwater ideas, but is there anything that from your standpoint, while we got you here, that we need to be looking at? Is there's a gap in either the regulatory side that to meet these recommendations?
I think the good news is that there are many ongoing efforts that are filling the gap. I know our water committee and members across the industry spent a lot of time with the Water Development Board during the interim last time, looking at the brackish water zones and providing data in many circumstances to help the Water Development Board in that process. You know, traffic was mentioned a good bit, and you were out in parts of it, and there were some very good comments. Two things on traffic. One is road impact that's been mentioned here today, but also safety. Industry has some very tangible examples. We have safety groups that work with OSHA that have developed safety programs that are pushed out throughout the industry, in the service industry, and with the companies directly. So the good news is, in America, entrepreneurial spirit recognizes you have to be responsible players to continue to do that. And in many of these instances, if something's identified, you have industry working with regulators that comes up and finds these solutions. And so that seems to continue to be the process here.
And again, I didn't hear the seismicity part. I just read it in here, and I know there's been some media misrepresentation about some of the findings. And but talk a little bit about the industry's again response. I know disposal wells. The focus is now on disposal wells, and especially in the Fort Worth Basin. And I know that there were a couple of wells in particular that the commission has focused in on, and I thought the industry has been very responsive to that, whether it be production levels or disposal levels, volumes, that sort of thing. Talk about how, from an industry standpoint, from your perspective, or each of your perspectives, perhaps, on how the industry has been sensitive to those concerns and working with the scientific community and trying to, and the Railroad Commission, to try to make sure we are responsive when we need to be.
And Dr. Stump did a good job and had the opportunity to repeat himself in stating that fracking was not been a factor in seismic activity here in Texas. There's a correlation between disposal wells, as you alluded to, and the industry has stepped up and done its part. First of all, the legislature did your part, and you've created funding to make certain that the deployment of seismometers was all across the state of Texas, and the collection of and analyzing that data through the proper disciplines that were there. Industry was very supportive of that. Industry is partnering in the funding of CSER for the continued study. Industry was supportive of the Railroad Commission's rules to ensure that seismic activity is taken into consideration prior to the permitting of any new disposal wells. And industry, a lot of different phases. The IOGCC is looking at the first stage report. You have a lot of industry players from across the nation, not just in Texas, that are looking and offering data on many different fronts. The good news is for us in Texas, there's a lot of good reasons to be a Texan, but our geology and is different here than it is even in neighboring Oklahoma, where you have a higher level of seismic activity. And so looking at that individual geology and looking at that data and then forming your regulatory program around that is the best way to go. And industry has worked collectively together to do that and sharing that information and working together. So there's tangible examples there.
I'm just looking through the report. Are you able to comment about how the industry and the commission have required more extensive geologic information before a permit is granted? I mean, again, recognizing that we now know more before we grant a permit. Talk about, if you're able to, the added data, the added below surface geological information that needs to happen before the commission passes on granting that permit. If you're able to. I don't think, is anybody from the Railroad Commission here? Good idea, don't show up. So we might ask you a question. So if you're able, you know, and I can direct my comments to the commission, but I just want to point out that based upon a lot of the study in this report, the commission now armed with more technology and subsurface maps is able to now have that due process happen before the permit's granted. So are you able to talk to that?
I mean, I'll just mention, I think it was discussed today briefly, but the Railroad Commission updated statewide rules 3.9 and 3.46, which put additional requirements on disposal well permit companies, thus asking them or requiring them to provide historical seismic data within proximity of that disposal well. And it also affirmed the commission's authority to terminate or modify disposal well if there was any scientific evidence in relation to that disposal well and seismic activity in the area. So those were some of the proactive efforts by the Railroad Commission to address that particular issue, and obviously a number of other sensible discussions related to regulations on seismicity. But 3.9 and 3.46 was a collaborative effort. It addressed specifically the area where seismicity was occurring and any potential correlation to Class C or Class 2 disposal wells.
Correct.
And I think one of the researchers had mentioned it prior, the more information we continue to gather, the better information that will be. And again, right now you have to go on the USGS website and type in the exact location and you get the perimeter search. And the more we're able to look at where those are happening, the better we'll be able to try to predict where they might happen.
Absolutely. The purpose in TexNet and all the dollars put in is we need the data to drive the discussion.
Exactly.
So. Well, again, thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions for you? Oh, Representative Walling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This might be more of a comment, but to the gaps, Chairman, with the development of the energy sector in Mexico, is the industry, and might be for the academic folk as well, will we be looking at environmental impacts once security is better in northern Mexico? And once there is some type of development, we don't know what that might be. I do know that there's a couple of bills in Congress that try, by Representative Greer, I think it's a bipartisan bill that tries to develop more of the pipeline industry and what the environmental impacts to the state would be. Because, you know, looking at the maps, that, you know, Eagle Ford, I'm assuming, doesn't stop at the Rio Grande, right? So. It's just probably more of a comment than a suggestion, just to keep it on the radar screen that, you know, environmental impacts are transnational and are on both sides of the border, particularly with a lot of interests of U.S. companies going down and transnational companies trying to go down and develop that industry. And so I don't know if you have a comment to that, but it's probably more of a rhetorical question.
Sure. No, it's a very, very valid question, and one is an expectation that Texas is going to benefit from that development in Mexico. A comment was made last summer that said when it comes to oil and gas, made in America means something because everyone comes here for the technology and the breakthrough ways and innovative ways to do things. I think we continuously have tangible examples of ways that the environmental footprint is mitigated with oil and gas development. You mentioned pipelines and the infrastructure that's there. Pipelines are the safest way to transport oil and natural gas. The spills are minimized. We talked a lot about traffic. You either it's on the roads in a truck, it's on a railroad, or it's in a pipeline. And clearly, pipelines are the safest way. The report pointed out on land use section about how there are multiple wells drilled now from one pad site, and how that is reducing land fragmentation issues and environmental impact when that's accomplished. And so there's some great examples of how that's occurring. I think that will be shared with the future development in Mexico and just greater technological breakthroughs every day that are occurring.
I mean, my hope is particularly on the oil services part, mm-hmm. you know, that my guys in Houston, and I mean statewide, right, but particularly in Houston, that we have a huge opportunity to go down there and develop that industry and it'd be fruitful for both sides of the border.
And I think that will continue. There's been some good success stories thus far. I think they've primarily focused on the Gulf blocks when they put the leases out thus far, but Texas is benefiting and Houston's energy capital of the world. So there's a lot more good in store, I believe, from that.
Thank you, panel.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Members, if you'll bear with me a second, that's all on our TAMIS study for today, the report. But I do want to bring up HCR 20. Members, if you had an opportunity to review the information that hopefully is included. Okay. I'm going to call Alex. Okay, I'd like to begin with HCR 20.
Do we need to lay this down?
Yeah.
Okay. At this time, Chair lays out HCR 20 and would call Alex Schock and Natalie Dubiel in General Counsel's office with the Railroad Commission of Texas to serve as resource witnesses. Members, HCR 20 was brought to my office by the Railroad Commission, and I think you have the background on this, but Alex and Natalie, would you kind of give us a Reader's Digest version of why the HCR 20 is necessary and you'd like for the committee to consider adopting it?
Sure. Good afternoon, Chairman and members. For the record, my name is Alexander Schock, and I'm the General Counsel of the Railroad Commission of Texas. This case has been pending in the courts for several years, and it's got a long history in the courts. Initially tried several years ago up to the Texas Supreme Court and back. Currently in the court, district court, and set for trial in September.
And Alex Ford, sorry. I want to make sure you testify that you're before the committee today on HCR 20.
HCR 20, correct.
Yes, okay.
Yes, sir, as a resource witness, correct.
Yes, thank you.
And the case has been pending and all relates to an inadvertent plugging of an offshore well back several years ago. Natalie's been handling the case for us, so I thought I'd let her get into some of the details to give you more background.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Natalie Dubiel also testifying on HCR 20. The original resolution allowed a Gulf Energy Exploration Corporation to sue the Railroad Commission for up to $2.5 million in damages, because the Railroad Commission's contractor had inadvertently plugged one of their wells. This occurred in 2008, so it's been almost 10 years at this point. And since that resolution was passed, as Alex alluded, it's been up to the Texas Supreme Court, been remanded back down to the district court, and it's now set for a whole new trial. But we've also had some changed circumstances that have been brought to light, most notably that Gulf Energy has received a $3 million settlement from the contractor Superior Energy Services. And so we feel since the original resolution contemplated $2.5 million in damages to redrill the plugged well, they've now received $3 million and have been fully compensated.
And a key point of that, the original resolution allowed Gulf to sue the commission and thereby sue its contractor as well.
This was 72, SCR 72?
SCR 72, okay. Yes, sir. And absent that resolution, Gulf Energy may not have had any recourse. It, by suing the commission and also suing the contractor, it had recourse against both parties potentially. It was very close to trial when the contractor Superior settled for $3 million. That settlement was on the record. So we feel that the initial resolution probably was beneficial and its intended purpose was fulfilled because it enabled the party to get the $3 million settlement to cover the ostensible $2.5 million of projected costs.
How do you respond? I mean, the legislature has been reluctant to interfere with the judicial process. Obviously, we have sovereign immunity, and we've waived that under SCR 72. But now there's pending litigation, and you're asking, I guess the commission's asking for to bring this to conclusion. Your position is Gulf has received full compensation for their damages. Mm-hmm. And they're still pursuing the claim against the state for recovery of additional damages.
That's correct. The SCR 72 had a limit, as you know, of $2.5 million recovery. And that $2.5 million was intended to, reflecting their estimates, intended to be the money to go out and redrill the well. Okay. The $3 million not only exceeds that, but the other fact that Natalie alluded to change facts, these folks have never gone out and redrilled the well. In fact, the leases have expired with no further work being performed. So our point is, even having recovered $3 million, even if they were to get another $2 million, $2.5 million, they couldn't use it in any event because they're 639. They're no longer even qualified to operate oil and gas wells, and they no longer have leases on these properties. So okay. It would be not only a double recovery, it would be recovery that could not be used for the original purpose of redrilling a well.
Well, you're blessed to have a lot of lawyers up here on this panel, so I'm sure some of these lawyers might have a question in that regard. Chairman King.
Thank you, Chairman. So their additional claim for damages, what's that based on? Lost profits, not being able to extract the minerals, losing the lease for not...
It was based on a turnkey proposal of the cost to redrill that well, which was roughly $2.4 million. So the original resolution just capped it at $2.5 million. So the original resolution did not contemplate lost profits.
Okay, so but the pleadings that they've got out there right now, what are they? What's their damage model? What's the damage model or the?
Well, currently it's on the sixth amended petition, and that states that their damages are up to $11+ million, but they do acknowledge in that pleading that they are capped at the 2.5 per the resolution.
Okay, and so the 11 is comprised by?
Lost profits, okay. and the cost to redrill the well.
Okay.
To the best of my knowledge.
Okay, thank you.
So... I think we need it. Do we have anybody from the AG's office here? I hesitate to interfere with the pending lawsuit. Would the effect of if we were to pass HCR 20 and signed by the governor, in your opinion, that would mandate an end to the litigation with no additional recovery coming from the state with regard to this matter?
The resolution would essentially say there would be no damage award, that their damages are zero. I believe the AG would then use that resolution to get dismissal of the case. We have case law, we can provide that separately, that supports the idea that the session, this legislature could go further, could actually revoke SCR 72. There's a 1935 case which you can provide. We don't propose revocation of that SCR. This is in the nature of the legislature taking notice that subsequent events have occurred that have, in effect, fulfilled that original need. But it has an impact on litigation. The case I referenced had indicated that the legislature could even revoke a CR if it had an impact on pending litigation. And that was a Texas Supreme Court decision?
That's correct.
Yes.
So we have the ability to affect pending litigation by revoking the prior issued SCR.
Yes, sir. Legal authority, yes, sir.
The legal authority. Representative Hardy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony here today. One little more. There's been apparently some correspondence since August of 15 between the Commission and Gulf Energy Exploration concerning the abandonment of the well. What's the potential impact of that? I think there's a subsequent correspondence January 30th, 2017, where they were told the abandoned wells would be placed on the plug-only list, and that might create some potential liability that Gulf would conceivably incur. Could you amplify that? Tell us a little bit more about that exchange.
Sure. So the August of 2015 correspondence was based on Gulf's not renewing their P5 organization report, which they have to have to operate oil and gas wells in Texas. So that correspondence was notifying them that they were no longer an active organization. The January 30th, 2017 letter was stating that all five of Gulf's wells were considered abandoned and inactive, and that they'd be placed on the plug-only list if Gulf did not respond within 30 days. It's right to request a hearing, and Gulf did not respond. So,
has Gulf denied receiving that correspondence or in any way tried to refute they have an obligation to respond to that correspondence?
No, sir. In fact, we've had no response at all, but they were sent certified mail.
Okay, they were. So we can prove that that was actually received by Gulf. And then is any issues or potential claims that the state or the commission may have back against Gulf, have they been made part of the current litigation, the current proceeding?
Has any
counterclaim or other claim been asserted in the active litigation related to the potential liability of these abandoned wells?
Not at this point. The Railroad Commission doesn't have the opportunity by statute to pursue for those plugging costs until the wells have actually been plugged.
We've got an estimate that it could cost as much as $5 million to plug these offshore gas wells, but because we don't yet have the fund, well, we haven't yet plugged those wells, we can't make the counterclaim in the proceeding. That's been our counsel for the agency.
But although you may not be able to make the counterclaim in the proceedings, that might be a somewhat useful tool to bring this litigation to an appropriate conclusion if Gulf were perhaps aware of that potential.
We believe they're aware of it.
Yes, I would expect they would be. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Any questions?
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind. As the Honorable Representative Clardy just said, no counterclaims currently in this suit. If we were to change and do HCR 20, would that, if there was a counterclaim coming from the state side, would that be in this current lawsuit or would that be in a separate lawsuit?
It would be a separate lawsuit. Okay. After the wells were plugged, we would refer it to the AG, and it would be a separate lawsuit.
Thank you.
Just thinking out loud, Mr. Chairman, perhaps if the resolution were pending in the committee before any formal action were taken, with some anticipation of how this committee might see that resolution, this might be a good time to...
Well, I think this resolution is going to be left pending in the committee for a while.
Everybody have an opportunity to do the right thing.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for your testimony, and it's going to be the chair's intention to leave this matter pending before the committee. And so hopefully we can visit with the Attorney General's office. Is there some contact litigant with the Attorney General's office that perhaps we can communicate with?
We can pass that information.
Okay, yes, sir. Very good. Thank you for your testimony.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, members, if there's no further business to come forth the Committee on Energy Resources, we stand adjourned subject to call the chair. Thank you. Thank you for being here.